My name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And I just want to first say that the glow that she saw was, you know, that alcoholic glow? When you've been drinking forever and ever and ever and your body is just lit up all over the place? That's what she saw. But she was just as new as me practically, so she thought it was serenity maybe. Who knows? First, I want to thank Lee for this loving invitation to be of service this weekend. It was about 2 years ago, actually, that I was first invited. And thank you to Anne, wherever she is. I don't even know who Anne is, but I know she's here. Thank you for everything, for making this weekend possible, but in particular for allowing Karen to be my host for the weekend. You know, I know that you guys, if you've been around long enough, you know that there's no such thing as an accident or a coincidence. If you've been around here a while, if you're new, you'll get to know that there's no such thing as a coincidence. That truly, absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. It might seem like a mistake. It might seem like you just stumbled upon something, but nothing happens by mistake. And the fact that our paths have crossed again 25 years later is really incredible. And I also want to just take this opportunity to applaud Karen, and I would hope that you would do it as well. You know, for those of us that have been here a while, we know how hard it is to stay sober. I mean, I haven't had a drink a day at a time since July 26, 1979. I am a quarter of a century sober. Thank you. Thank you. And yes, girls, I know I look fabulous. 51 and loving every moment of it. It's AA, and it's hard to stay sober, whether it's for 5 minutes or for 25 years. But it's really, really, really hard to come into this program, to have some semblance of recovery, to go out and come back again. And so I just want you to know how much I appreciate your courage, because a lot of people don't get to show up again. So thank you. Thank you. And that goes for anybody who's in here tonight, either coming back, trying to come back, maybe not yet back. You know, my story is a story of what I like to think is hope and inspiration, as each of our stories is. In our own way, we each bring something to the table where we can inspire one other person. And I must also tell you that I know that everybody in this room is not going to relate to my story. But I believe that there is one woman in here tonight that came here specifically, whether she knew it or not. I believe she's here by divine appointment to hear my story in only the way that I could tell it. That's all. And it's only one woman. I believe that. Maybe a couple of others, but I know for a fact there's one woman in here. And so you know what? When they talked about the hurricanes, I got really scared about coming to Florida this weekend because I was afraid I wouldn't get back. And I said that to Anne on the phone the other day. I had to fly to Baltimore. And then I called her up and I said, Anne, I don't know if I want to come. But you know what? I was supposed to be here. And again, nothing happens in God's universe by mistake. And so I just want you to know how thrilled I am to be with you guys tonight. Especially because I just know without even knowing who's here, I know that there are some of you here tonight who have suffered a tremendous loss this week. Whether it's a loss of something tangible or whether it's a loss of something emotional or intangible. And I just want to say I'm glad you're here and you're in such a safe place with us this weekend. Use each and every one of us, and I'm going to be here all weekend. So if you need to use me, use me. But I am just so glad, so privileged to be amongst you guys. So thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm privileged to be sober. You know, what you're going to hear pretty much from me is how grateful I am to be sober. And the little details of how I got to be that way, but it's really that I'm so grateful to be standing up here. Because you see, people like me, people who have come from the places I've come from, women who have done the things that I have done in my life don't get to show up like I get to show up, but for Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I'm the woman who was on the street that people did not think was going to make it. Karen said she thought I was going to make it, but trust me, had you seen me when I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas in 1979, you wouldn't have thought I was going to make it. Because I probably wouldn't have had I not made it here. Oh, and by the way, just as an aside before I forget, how many of you like Vegas? And how many of you like, I know you do, and how many of you like women's conferences? Well, in Las Vegas, over the Valentine's Day weekend coming up, we are having the International Alcoholics Anonymous Women's Convention. And if you've never been there, every year we go to a different city. Next year, in 2005, February, we're going to be in Vegas. So if you're interested in a women's conference in Las Vegas, I hope I get to see you there. Because I'll be there. Anyway, so I was of the hopeless variety, and Alcoholics Anonymous literally picked me up and made me who I am today. You know, I heard a woman once speak at a conference, and she said something that I have always, always loved. She said, "I am brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous." And I am brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous. I've grown up in this program. I got sober when I was 26 years old, and I'm 51 now. You know, quickly becoming 52. I have grown up in this program. So, if you're newly sober, I want to say welcome. Welcome to the time of your life. And you might not believe that right now. If you're sitting here at this moment, maybe you're here because you want to be. Maybe somebody dragged you here. Maybe you're kind of, oh, there are a few of you, I can tell. I remember those days too. You know, whatever. You know, maybe you're sitting in here tonight and your hands are shaking and your palms are sweating and like the last place you want to be is in a women's meeting. Because maybe you really don't like women yet. I used to be that way. Maybe you don't want to be sitting in a women's meeting. Thank God there are two guys sitting up here, you're probably saying. You know, I know, I've been there. All I can say is don't give up before the miracle. Just stick around long enough for the fog to lift. And what is going to unfold in your life, if you are lucky enough to stay around, is a life so sweet, so delicious, so far beyond your wildest imaginings, you can't even believe it. You can't even believe it. I stand before you this evening a walking, talking, breathing example of Alcoholics Anonymous in the flesh. I stand before you a woman who walks with dignity. A woman today who knows how to spell that word and who knows how to define it. And I can tell you when I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1979, that was not my experience. It's not my experience. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, 51 years ago, and I don't remember an awful lot about those early days, and I don't know why. Maybe it's because I just forgot. Maybe it's because I drank so much that my brain cells are like so destroyed even now. You know, maybe some of those cells haven't, you know, grown back or recuperated themselves. Or maybe this God that I've come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous just didn't see fit for me to remember some of those things that I had done. Because who knows, maybe had I remembered one more thing, I might have cut the lights out. It might have been too much for me to bear that I might not have stuck around long enough for the fog to lift. But whatever the deal, what I remember most about growing up as a little kid in the South, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, growing up in the South, was I hated who I was. And you know what, ladies, I know that for many of us our experience is different, the little details of our lives are different, but I can imagine that many of us felt the same pain as each other in this room, and that was that pain of being different. No matter whether you were with people who looked like you or in your family, I just always felt different. I always felt like a round peg in a square hole. You know, I hated being black, I hated being a girl, I hated being a southerner, I hated being poor more than anything else. I really hated being poor. You know, I often hear speakers talk about they didn't know that they were poor. Well, that is not my experience. I knew I was poor. We grew up poor, and there was no question about it in my family that we had rats for bedfellows, you know, that we were eating plaster off the wall. I knew what it was like to be poor. You know, I knew what that was like, and I hated it. I hated every piece of me. I hated who I was. And there were times I wished I could just unzip my skin and step out because I just wanted to be somebody other than who I was. I just hated being me. You You know, when I was a little kid, the kids used to make fun of me. I moved to New York when I was 6 years old, and the kids just used to rip me apart. They used to call me all kinds of horrible, horrible names because I had a really strong southern accent, if you can possibly imagine that. And we were really poor, so I wore hand-me-downs, and I had these little pigtails that just looked horrible, too. And they used to just pick on me and pick on me. And at that stage of my life, I didn't have the kind of program for living that says you don't have to take that. I didn't have it. And so I took it. I took it and I absorbed it into every cell of my body. And God, it was a horrible experience. Sometimes I'd hate waking up in the morning. And so, you know, long before I ever picked up a drug or a drink, I knew I needed to get out of that place where I was. I knew even as a little kid that that pain was so great, I needed to find a way out. And my earliest escape in life came through books and movies. And it was wonderful. My mom's a librarian. And so in our house, we had books everywhere. We had reams and reams and reams of books in every room, on every wall. And it was wonderful because when I picked up a book, I was like Cinderella. It's fabulous. I was like Cinderella going to the ball. I became pretty and smart and clever. I mean, all the things that a little kid would want to do. I mean, it was perfect. When I opened up a book, between those binders was magic. I mean, there was magic. And for a moment, it didn't matter what you thought of me, and it didn't matter what I thought of me. For a moment, my life was just perfect. And the books and the movies worked for a long time, I must tell you. For a long time, they managed to take me away from the pain of growing up this poor little black kid in the South and ultimately the South Bronx. And it was really, really cool. And then, I have to tell you, I also used to escape in movies. I loved, 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 loved old movies. My favorite women were Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. They were women that had a glass in one hand. They had a cigarette in the other hand. Some of you remember. And they didn't take too much garbage off of anybody. I loved it. I mean, I used to eat them up. I mean, I watched those girls in the movies and I'd mimic what they did. Actually, I learned, this is so sick, I know it, but it's the truth. I learned how to walk by watching Betty Davis. I used to love that walk. I thought she was just as sexy as she could be, swishing around. And we used to have a full-length mirror in our house. And I used to stand in the mirror, this is a little kid, swishing like Betty Davis, you know. Hello. That should let you know that I was destined to be an alcoholic. I also learned how to smoke cigarettes by watching her. Some of you might remember the movie All About Eve, one of my favorite old movies. In the movie, she's got this party going on, and she's walking up this staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder, talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. Had she only known how bumpy a ride it was to become. Had she only known. And I learned how to hold my glass with my pinky stuck out, and I still have a tendency to do that. I learned how to do that by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. Anybody remember Backstreet? That was one of my favorite movies. And I must tell you, I learned a few other tricks of the trade by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. Not proud of where I come from, but you know what? It's who I was. And I learned how to sleep with other people's husbands by watching women like her in those movies, because those were the only role models I had. And for years and years, I mimicked who they were. I did what they did. I dressed like they dressed. I walked the way they walked. I flirted like they flirted. I did the things that they did. And for years, that's who I was. That's who I was. Today, I can tell you that that's no longer who I am. But in order for me to have changed from the person I used to be to the person I am today, I had to first come to terms with who I had become so I could change it. The books and the movies worked for a long time, and then they simply stopped working. One day, instead of taking me to another place that was safe, that felt comfortable, instead of that happening, I found that when I opened up a book or when I looked at the movies, I knew it was temporary. See, I knew that when the book was closed, when the movie was over, when the credits were rolling, that was the deal. That was it. And I was back to being exactly who I was, a nothing piece of nothing, because that's how I felt. And so, you know, I can't tell you that I then ran right out and decided I was going to go and use drugs and alcohol. I can't tell you that on a conscious level, that's what I was thinking. But trust me, that's exactly what was going on in my brain. I knew that when the books and the movies stopped working, I needed to find another quick fix to take away the pain. And I'm a product of the 60s. I grew up in New York City during that period. And so it was really, really easy to get hooked up with drugs and alcohol. It was about better living through chemistry. That was the deal. You know, I used chemicals to come up. I used chemicals to come down. I used chemicals to level myself out. You would have thought I was a chemist, actually. I mean, I used to mix that stuff, just the right amount. And for a long time, it worked. You know, I have to tell you, though, when I picked up that first drink, that first drug, I didn't know what was going to happen. And I can tell you just for me, just for me. Had I had a crystal ball and been able to look down the road at where I was to eventually go due to my drinking and using, just for me, I would have never picked up the first drink. Had I known where I was going to go as a woman alcoholic for the next 12, 14 years of my life, had I known, instead of picking up a drink, I would have picked up a gun. You see, there's no way in the world I would have ever, knowing what was in the lion's den, consciously walked in there saying, yes, take me. I would have never done it. I'm a coward. I wouldn't have done it. I would have cut the lights out. But you see, I didn't know what was in store. I didn't know. I didn't have a clue. And I guess lucky me, because I get to stand up here today, a clean and sober woman who has a different experience and a story to tell. I didn't know at the time, but how grateful I am. How grateful I am that I didn't have the courage to cut the lights out. In 1978, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed it then, but I didn't think I did. And I bet some of you can relate to that. I was only 25 years old, and I just knew that 25-year-old women couldn't be alcoholics. I mean, I watched those movies. You know, girls weren't alcoholics. Alcoholics were those old men on the Bowery. Anybody from New York, you will remember the Bowery. And I'm sure in every town there's a Bowery-like community, you know, where the old men would come around with the overcoats and they'd have the bottle hanging out of the back of their pocket and they'd have those big fat blood vessels popping out of their face from too much booze. That was an alcoholic. That was not me. That was not me. By the end of my drinking, I was living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan wearing diamonds and furs, sleeping my way up the ladder. That was not me on the Bowery. So I thought. Forgot to tell you about the times when I came to in Central Park with those fur coats on. I'd gone all the way down, and yet I knew that I wasn't an alcoholic. I'd forgotten, too, about the women that I saw in the movies. You know, like Susan Hayward in I'll Cry Tomorrow, she was an alcoholic. If there were any women that were alcoholics, it was her. She was digging in the garbage can, looking for booze in the corner of the bottle. Hello, how many times did I do that one? But I conveniently forgot. I mean, there were many a day when I either was too sick to get up and go to the store or didn't have any money, I would pull that bottle out of the garbage can and drink the last corner. I know there's some of you that relate to that. Some of you are giving me that look, but I know some of you relate. I know it. Just like with the cigarettes, I'd dig at the bottom. I mean, that's how pathetic I had become at the end. I'd dig at the bottom of the trash can for that last little butt that was so turned and so disgusting. I'd burn my lips trying to get a puff. That's how far down the scale I went. And yet, for me, I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was way too young. It's an amazing thing. Alcoholism, they say, is a disease of perception. And it really is. It's the only disease that tells us we don't have a disease. It's the only disease that tells us you could be all dressed up and think you're like Miss Priss, and you're nothing but a drunk. And that's the place I came from. So in 1978, when I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just didn't think I belonged here. And so as a result, I continued to drink. I continued to drink, and I continued to use, and I continued to act out in the only way I could act out. You know, it's an interesting thing, too. I think about When I was a kid, my mother did the very best she could. And my mom and I didn't get along until I got sober. But I can tell you today, I know my mother did the very best she could today, really, in trying to make me a really good little kid. She taught me things that, you know, she taught me what she knew, and she wanted me to be a little respectful kid. And you know what? Until I picked up that first drink, and that's not even true, because you know what, that self-loathing was always inside, and once I picked up the booze, it was just like you put kerosene or fire on the kerosene, how do you say it? Kerosene on the flame or whatever, it explodes. You know, I always was a woman who compromised myself to the point that I didn't even realize what I was doing was a compromise. My mother didn't train me to be that way. She really didn't. She didn't train me to act the way I acted, and yet, when I started to drink and when I started to use, that's who I had become. I had become vile and wretched. I had become a pathetic woman, and I was only 25 years old. It's only 25. So when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I, even though I didn't stick around, the seed was planted. And that's the power of this program. You know, they often say that if you come in and you go out again, even if you go out, your drinking will be destroyed. It'll be ruined because you'll always be thinking about us. Hello. You'll always be seeing our face every now and then. I mean, look at all of you that come back. You still think of us, even a little bit. I just lost it. A senior moment, just. What was I saying? That's what happens. You try to build rapport and you get off on a tangent. And anybody remember where it was? I love this. This is good. Oh, good. Excellent. You know, I have to tell you, I'm an interactive trainer and I like when people participate. This is very good. This is so cool. Anyway. I really forgot where I was. Where? Oh, 25 years old. Okay. So I moved to Las Vegas. That's bottom line what I was going to say. At the end of my drinking, when I couldn't stop, at the end of 1978, the seed had been planted. I had come to AA, but I hadn't stuck around. And so at the end of 78, I moved to Las Vegas looking for my pot of gold. Anybody relate to that? Where you move from one place to another thinking you leave all your baggage back there? Yeah. Hello. I left New York in 1978 thinking that I was going to leave all that stuff in New York. And I moved to Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, if that's not sick, people say to me, Francine, you moved from the frying pan into the fire. Hello. You know, how could you get sober there? I moved out there because I'm an alcoholic and because my mind is one of an alcoholic. And I thought if I left New York and moved to Vegas, I was going to find panacea. It was going to be the perfect nirvana for me. And what I found instead was sobriety. I found sobriety 8-9 months after I moved. And I didn't plan on it. I didn't want it. But that's what I found. I moved in November. I think it was the end of October, beginning of November. And I got hit by a car in June of 1979. And it takes what it takes for some of us. You know, and I remember the last thing I remember was I was sitting in a discotheque in Las Vegas, Nevada called The Brewery, appropriately named The Brewery. It's no longer there. And the next thing I remember was the following morning I came to with my entire body in traction, one of those big body braces, and my left leg was in a cast all the way up my thigh. And I have to tell you, I don't have a clue how I got there. And I know some of you relate to that. I don't have a clue. And what I was told by the cops that had found me in the street, found my mutilated body in the middle of Paradise Road, and the doctors that had put my body back together, what they said to me was when I was found in the street, they never thought I was going to live. And when they realized I was going to live, they never thought I'd walk again. Because when they found me, my left leg had come up behind my head, and the bone had come straight through. And I have to tell you, I don't hide it. I actually have a really attractive 10-inch scar on my leg with a lot of hole marks. It's really ugly. My leg's not pretty. But I, you know what, I wear short skirts and bathing suits all the time. And over the years, people have asked me, have I ever considered cosmetic surgery? Because the scar is really, really so ugly. And you know what? I can just tell you that for today, I choose not to cover it up. Who knows? Maybe next year I'll change my mind. But for today, you see, every time I look at this leg, I am reminded of every drink I took, of every drug I took, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I performed. And you see, for me, it's important to remember that, because the truth is, when you're sober as long as I am sober, and when your life has changed as dramatically as mine has changed, it becomes so easy to forget. I've seen many people with more time than me go out, and it is not so uncommon. It becomes really, really, really easy to forget the pain of picking up that first drink and how I allowed people to abuse my body and abuse my mind because I thought I had no choice. See, I don't ever, ever, ever want to forget that. And so for today, I keep the leg like it is, and I see it. You know, it's a reminder of those good old days, if you will. You know, what it was like when I was hanging out, having fun. I'd like to tell you, however, that that this accident that was severe was enough to get me sober. I'd like to tell you that. But you know what? For those of you in here that are real alcoholics, you know that no little car accident is going to stop you if you are on a mission. And it doesn't. And it didn't for me. In my disease, in my sickness, I continued to drink for another month and a half. Now, if that's not sick, I don't know what is. And you know what? I was on crutches and couldn't even function. I didn't know how to drive at the time. I couldn't even get up to go to the bathroom. I couldn't take care of myself. But you know what? Somehow I found somebody, some sick, equally sick soul, who would go buy my drugs and my booze. He needed the money, and I needed the drugs, and we were a perfect, horrible companion. You know, that's how far down the scale I went. And then, in July of 1979, something happened. And I can't really tell you what it was. I can't tell you that there was a bolt of lightning or there was some, you know, big white light. I can't tell you because that's not what happened for me. All I know is on one particular day, one particular morning, I came to and I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. I don't know why on this day, why it was different than any other, because the truth is it wasn't my worst drunk. It wasn't my worst drunk. This particular day, it was a relatively harmless day, relatively. But on this day, I woke up, I came to, and I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And I had remembered Alcoholics Anonymous from the year before when I first came in New York when I couldn't stay sober. And I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas. And I can tell you that I pray to God that that's the first time I ever have to pick up the phone because I'm drinking and say I need help. I pray to God that never has to happen again. It's not guaranteed, though. I'll tell you, it's not guaranteed. But I pray to God, if I keep doing the things that I do today, I won't pick up tomorrow. I haven't had a drink or drug since then, and that was July 26, 1979. You know, and that's a day that will go down in my own personal history book as a monumental day. It's a significant day. And yet, you know, I'd also like to tell you that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous as sick as I was, just really embracing you with open arms. I'd like to tell you that I just ran in here and I was willing to do exactly what you told me to do. Duh. Many of us know that one. You know, it didn't take but a minute for me to, like, get back into old behavior, like a day or so. A day, you know, a day or so of not drinking and then feeling just a tad bit better. And then all of a sudden, I was back to normal. Bad attitude. I mean, it's horrible. I used to sit in the back of the room, and this was my favorite section. I endearingly like to call it the inventory section. Oh, some of you relate to that one, huh? I sit in the inventory section, and I would take up three seats. Now, who needs three seats in an AA meeting? I don't care how sick you are. Who needs three seats? Well, I thought I did. One for my bottom, one for my broken leg and one for my crutches. Why couldn't my crutches be on the floor? I put my crutches in a chair because it was my bad attitude. I wanted to show you. And I'd sit in the back and I'd have my arms crossed. And I have to tell you, I hated everybody. I came in here, I hated men, I hated women, and that doesn't leave a whole lot of people in between. I mean, it was horrible. I just didn't like anybody. I'd sit back there, and I would just dare you to make my day. I would dare you to say something that was going to make me want to stick around. It was horrible. I don't know how I stayed sober, actually. I really don't know how I stayed sober. But for the grace of God. I stuck around, and it was about 30 days sobriety that I was gifted with, to me, probably the single most important gift in my sobriety, and one of the single most important gifts in my life, and that was the woman that I was to call my sponsor for many, many, many years. And I just want to say that, especially if you are new, my prayer for you is that you are lucky enough to have someone who loves you enough to tell you the truth. Because you don't often find it anymore. And, you know, I hated this woman with a passion. I swear to God. I hated Louise. Karen knew Louise. I couldn't stand her. She was so intimidating. She just was horrible. And she didn't care that I didn't like her. I need to let you know that. It didn't matter to her. And, you know, and she was right, because I didn't like her, you know. All she ever talked about was action, gratitude, service, and God. Things that not only I didn't know about, but really wasn't interested in, you know. And she just, you know, she just was really tough. Personally, I think she was too old. I think she was too old, and I think she was sober too long. She forgot what it was like to be a newcomer, you know. When I met Louise, she was 19 years sober, and she was like 59 years old. And, I mean, she was just a little too hard on me. That's what I thought. She was just a little too hard. And you know what? As much as I disliked her in the beginning, this is to the degree I love her today. She died 2 years ago, and although she physically is no longer here, her legacy lives with me. Because so much of who I am as a woman is about who Louise was as a woman. She had the courage to tell me the truth when I did not want to hear it. And I'd like to share with you three things in particular that she called me on that were really important for me. And again, I didn't like them in the moment, but they became critical in my becoming the woman that I am today. The first thing, first let me say overall, she used to talk about self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And she used to repeat it over and over and over again. She said, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, you know, Francine, if you act like a whore, you're going to be treated like a whore. If you dress like a hooker, you're going to be treated like a hooker. If every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, she said, then don't be surprised if you get that message back. She said, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And one of the first things she taught me was that it was not an esteemable act that I should be sleeping with other people's husbands. Period. Period. I mean, I know some of you get that, but I didn't. Again, I was watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet, so I didn't get it. She didn't think that was such a good idea. Plus, she reminded me that there probably was a connection between the fact that I didn't have any girlfriends and I was sleeping with all their husbands. So that was the first thing. I must tell you that there is not one single woman in this room that would ever, ever have to worry about me in the room with her man. That might not be a big thing to some of you, but to me it's monumental. To me, that is the essence of who I am as a woman today. I have lots of girlfriends. I am my own girlfriend. I am my own best friend today. Because I am someone who lives in integrity. Furthermore, I must tell you, I have enough to deal with my own husband. I don't want yours. God, one is enough. The second esteemable act that she taught me that was really important, oh, thank you, thanks, was that I needed to, that it was not appropriate that I should go to AA meetings with bikinis on. Now, I don't know if Karen remembers this. She should, because I used to go to meetings all the time dressed like this. I used to wear hot pants the size of a sash. You know what a sash looks like? Do you know about how big a sash is? Not very big. A sash, and you could see my cheeks hanging out, and I'm not talking about my facial cheeks. I'd go sashaying into meetings with a sash, and I'd have blouses that were open so far down my navel, you wondered why I had anything on. You know, a few years ago, some of you might remember, they had that big to-do about Jennifer Lopez and that piece of scarf she wore to the Grammys. She had nothing over on me. I tell you. I was such a piece of work. This is 4 years sober even. You know, up to about four or five years sober. Horrible. I mean, really disgusting. Louise taught me it was not an esteemable act that I should dress like a hooker, period. And she taught me how to dress differently. She taught me how to dress appropriately for the occasion. Yes, I wear bikinis, but on the beach. At the pool, not in a public, you know, not at a meeting. And the third thing she taught me that was really important for someone like me was I came in with a filthy mouth. Every other word out of my mouth was a four-letter word, and it was disgusting. And you know, the truth is, you would have thought I didn't know any other words, because all I ever did was curse. And she helped me realize, which she was such an insightful woman, she helped me realize that every single time I cursed, people laughed. And I even noticed that today. When people curse, there could be dead silence in a room, somebody curses, everybody laughs. And I realized, thanks to her, that it was better for me to get negative attention rather than no attention at all. You see, I was so needy that if you just laughed, at least I felt like you connected with me, even if you were laughing at me. The other thing that she helped me realize was that because I hated myself so much and I never believed that I had anything of value to contribute, that it was easier when I cursed, I took the focus off of my message and I put it on me. So you never listened to what I said. And I never thought what I had to say was important anyway. Today it's not like that. Today I believe I have a message. Today I want you to hear the message. I don't want you to get distracted by curse words. And maybe some of you won't, but you know what? Even if one person gets distracted by my cursing, I don't want to do it. Today I've learned how to substitute my language. I've learned how to substitute curse words for words that are more appropriate. I have a vocabulary today. I learned that in AA. And it's interesting, I was one of the real sick cases, and this is the truth. Louise helped me reduce my cursing content from like 10 curse words to a sentence to 5 curse words to a sentence. It's very true. She had to work with me, and then it was like 3 curse words to a sentence. Then it was like 1 curse word. Then it was like every other sentence had a curse word until I wasn't cursing. And you know what? Today I choose not to curse, and it's a choice I make. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. When I do things that make me feel good about me, I feel good about me. As my insides were starting to change, my outsides were also starting to change. And I started to think I wanted to do something with my life. And that was a big deal because, I mean, I was an ex-hooker with a criminal record. That's what I did. That's what I did for a living. I didn't know anything else. I was not a woman of substance, so I thought. I never utilized my brain. I dropped out of school when I was 18 years old, and not one of the men, not one of my benefactors ever asked me if I had a degree. You know, none of them cared. I mean, they didn't care that I wasn't educated, and you know what? For many years, I didn't either. For many years, I didn't care whether I had an education or whether I was, you know, I could hold a conversation with someone. It never mattered because for me, as long as my body was intact and my face looked okay, that's all that mattered because that's what the guys I wanted were attracted to. Well, at 2 years sobriety, that started to change. Started to change because I had a sponsor who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And at 2 years sobriety, I decided I wanted to go back to school to pursue a career that was so far beyond anything I could dream of. I didn't think it was possible. But yet, in my heart, I had a dream. And let me just say, my story mostly in recovery is about dreams. You know, I'm one of those people who were taught that you couldn't have anything. I grew up in the South Bronx. I grew up, you know, believing that dreams were for other people. They were for people on the other side of the tracks. And I was taught that you don't dare go for the moon because if you do and you fail, then you're nothing. So it was easier not to even try. And you know what? Most of my life I gave up. I didn't even go for the dreams that I even for a moment might have had because I knew I couldn't do it anyway. And Louise one day, when I told her what I was thinking about doing, she said, you know, Francine, you can have anything you want in sobriety if you are willing to do the work. She said, you can have anything in sobriety. Anything. And she underscored anything, and she underscored if you are willing to do the work. That was the tough part. Willing to do the work. She said, you know what, if you want to sit back and use all kinds of things as excuses for why you can't have anything in life, go for it. You know, she said, if you want to use your race as an excuse, because I was notorious for saying, but I'm black, they're not going to let me do it. Whoever they are, I didn't know, but they're not going to let me live my life. That was my major excuse. And then my equally horrible excuse was, well, I'm only a girl. I'm only a girl. I can't do anything. So I used my race, I used the fact that I was a girl, and I also used my history, my past, as an excuse for not doing anything. She said, if you want to use those things, go for it. If you want to use your race, if you want to use the fact that you're a girl, if you want to use the fact that you have a colorful past, fine. But she said, if you want to do something different, if you want to change the course of your life right here and right now, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous can help you do it. But if you want to sit back and bemoan the fact that, yeah, poor you, you had a tough life, poor you, whatever, you can do that. So a day at a time, because I'm a girl who takes a challenge, you know, and she taught me how to do that. I decided to go back to school when I was 2 years sober. And I had to first get my GED. I was a high school dropout, had no education. And I got my GED, and you know, I wanted to share this piece because I bet you there's somebody in here like that. I used to lie a lot about having even a little education. I used to tell people I was a high school graduate. I even dared to tell people I had gone to like a year or two of college. Trust me, nobody in their right mind believed that because it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that I had no college when I was newly sober, but I told people that. But you know what? I was really ashamed of where I was. I was ashamed that I had no education. I went and bought this GED book, and when company would come to my house, I would hide it underneath my bed. Now, I lived alone, but I hid it under the bed because I was so ashamed that people would see it. But you know what? When they were gone, I'd study it. I studied it, and I studied it, and I eventually got my GED, and I started college at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I decided I wanted to go for this career that was so, again, it was so far removed from anything I knew, but I wanted to do it. And Louise said, go for it. So I finished, I started college in Vegas, and then I moved back to New York City in 1982 because what I wanted to do, I couldn't do in Vegas. They didn't have the kind of educational provisions there. I put myself through college. It took me 5 years. I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. And I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And it's really important that I share that because what I have discovered over the years is that newcomers between those very delicate years of 1 and 5, the ones that go back to school, the ones that get the right job, or the ones that are in the right relationship, all of a sudden nobody has time to go to meetings. And what happens is maybe after hanging out or not showing up at a meeting for a month or two or three, then they come back and then they want to share all their experiences in the one little share. So those of us that have been here all the time. And it becomes a dumping session. And Louise said to me, you know what? AA works under those conditions. It works. You can go to a meeting once every 3 months and come and share. And you can probably stay sober that way. But she said, why would you want to? She said, you know what? The deal is, Francine, you have a responsibility to go to meetings whether you want to go or not. Number one, because the only way you are sitting in anybody's classroom is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, did you forget where you just came from? So that was the first thing she reminded me that I had to show up just for myself as a reminder of where I had come from. But secondly, she told me it was important that I keep coming to meetings as a reminder to you. Because each of us has a responsibility, so I believe, and so did my sponsor, that we have a responsibility to help one another. to show by example, to help one another in every way we can. And sometimes that simply means that you're sitting in a meeting and when somebody comes, they know that there's a place to go. Because there's a meeting because you're there. And even if you're having a tough time, which all during school, I had a tough time. It was really hard, but I showed up in meetings and I talked about it. I let people know. And the good news is, yes, I was having a tough time, but I was living a dream. I was having a tough time because I was living a dream. How cool is that? So I got to show up for myself, have a place to complain, and support other people, and I did, and support other people along the way. And the good news, too, is you know what? It paid off for me down the road, because every time I showed up for me at a meeting, I was adding something to my little insurance policy, and eventually there would come a time when I really needed it. Eventually there would come a time. I graduated from college in 1986, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And in 1989, I moved back to New York, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can tell you, you don't get... Thank you. Thank you. I'll tell you, you don't get from where I was to where I am, but for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. You just don't. You know what? At least I didn't. I didn't. I mean, I remember, and this sort of is an aside, it took me a long time to become a lawyer, and I'll tell you that piece, but I remember when I first started practicing law in New York, I had a criminal case, and I went to criminal court. This is so true. I had a defendant there, and when the judge said, "Will the defendant stand?" I swear to God, it is true, I stood. I swear to God, because I had been in that same court many times before. Fortunately, as the lawyer, I mean, they thought I was just standing with the defendant. But, I mean, it was like I had to catch myself. I know, it's so sick, so true. Life is funnier than fiction, always. I want to also tell you that it didn't happen overnight that I became a lawyer, because what I have found in the years I'm sober is many of us have dreams. And probably some of you in here today, and if you do, I hope to see you tomorrow at the workshop, because we're going to talk about making some dreams come true. But many of us have dreams, but you know what? Many of us are afraid to go for the dream because we're afraid we're going to fail. We're afraid we're going to fail. We're afraid we're going to stumble and fall. We're afraid we're going to be rejected. We're afraid we won't have the support we need. We're afraid of all kinds of stuff. And the truth is, you might not have the support you think you need. There's always support, but you might not be able to get what you think you need. And you might fail along the way. That's the deal. I failed. Before I became a lawyer, I kept failing the bar over and over again. I couldn't get through it. Kept failing the bar. And you know what? There were times when I wanted to give up, but I didn't. And as a result of not giving up, of showing up, and of figuring out what I was supposed to be doing differently, I eventually got a license to practice law. But I had to be willing to go for the dream at whatever cost. I had to be willing to stumble and fall and look stupid and talk about it in meetings. Because I have to tell you, when I was putting myself through school, I was speaking at AA conventions practically every weekend. And it was the hardest time for me. And every time I got up and talked about failing the exam, you guys supported me. Every time. I didn't do it alone. You guys supported me. I'm a dreamer. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the ability to dream. And then you made a mistake and said to me, "Francine, it doesn't have to end with being a lawyer. You can have any kind of dream you want." You made the mistake of telling me I could do anything I want. And 11 years ago, some of you might remember Dr. Paul, from Dr. Alcoholic Addict. Dr. Paul was one of my closest friends. He was one of my mentors. And Dr. Paul, 11 years ago, said to me, "Francine, you have a book inside of you." And I said, "Yeah, right." You know, because again, that was fear talking. Fear was talking, because I would never have dreamt of putting any words on paper, because you'd read it and you'd judge me and I don't like to be judged. So for years, I kept playing this mind game. Dr. Paul kept asking me along the path, so what's going on with the book? And I kept saying, oh, I'm thinking about it. But years kept going by, and I was afraid to put pen to paper. Finally, before Dr. Paul died in 2000, one of the last things he said to me was, Francine, stop playing this game. Stop playing this game. He said, you can do it. And no, you may not do it perfectly, but you can do it. And he had already written two books by that time. And so, again, because my whole story is about walking through fear. My whole story is about walking through fear. Every day, it's about taking one little baby step, putting one foot in front of the other, being afraid, having the courage to admit I'm afraid, and doing the footwork anyway. And as a result of being willing to show up for myself one more time, last year I published my first book. Right. Who would have thought? Who would have thought? It's like now Alcoholics Anonymous has given me yet another dream. And you know what? I'm sure I've got more dreams down the road. I don't know what they are, but I'm an open vessel. 51 years old, I've got plenty of time to go. Plenty of time. You know, when I was newly sober, I was invited to make a list of all the things that I wanted out of my recovery. And on that list, you would have found a litany of every single material thing I lost. You would have found fur coats and diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos. You would have never, ever, ever found the things that I value the most today. Those intangible things that not one of you can take away from me. Not one of you. Those things such as self-esteem. The genuine kind for me that comes from walking through fear. Because see, that's what self-esteem comes from walking through fear. That's what I've discovered. Every time I do something I'm afraid to do and I get to the other side, it's like a little check next to my name. And that in turn gives me the courage to do something else, which gives me the courage to do something else. And before you know it, I'm doing things I never thought I could do. And I'm feeling different inside. One of the other things you'd find on that list today is the gift of courage. And for me, courage is not what I used to think it was. I used to believe that courage was an absence of fear. Today, for me, it means being afraid and walking through it. That's courage for me. See, I'm not going to even stand up here and tell you that I'm not scared every time I get up on the platform and speak. Every time I have to tell you the truth about who I am, that's a scary proposition, because there's always the fear that people are going to judge me. And you know what? They do. There are people that judge me all the time. There are people in here that are judging me. You know what? It's got to be okay. Courage is doing it anyway. It's walking through the fear. It's feeling those feelings and doing it anyway, because for everybody that's judging me, I believe there's one person I'm helping. That's all. And you know what? If at the end of the day I can say that I've used my life for the benefit of one more person, then it's worth it. It's worth walking through the fear. What you'd also find on that list today is the Emma. What you'd also find on that list today is the gift of my mother. And I know that's a really touchy subject to talk about in a women's meeting in particular, and I'm just sharing with you my own experience around that. I hated my mother like you would not believe when I got sober. And I know some of you could probably relate. You know, I was so grateful when I first came here when I heard the women who hated their moms too. You know, and they talked about it openly in meetings. I appreciated that because I didn't feel like a leper, because I felt like, you know, somebody understood. So I was really, really grateful for those women. I will also say that I eventually became grateful for the women who became willing to use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on their relationships with their mothers. Because when the time came for me to change mine with my mom, it's you that I look to. And thank God there were some women who didn't stay stuck in the fact that they didn't like their moms. They used this program to change that condition. Today my mother is one of my best friends. And it is so unbelievable. She's one of my best friends. Does that mean that we have a perfect relationship and we're always getting along just fine? Absolutely not. My mom's human, as I am. But one of the things that was really interesting for me is I had to come to terms with the fact that she is human. You see, I'm one of those sick people who wanted my mother, I wanted her to be perfect. I wanted her to be the perfect mother, but I wanted her to understand that I was only human. So when I made a mistake, I wanted her to overlook it. But when she made a mistake, boy, I had a whip next to her in a hot minute. She couldn't make no mistakes. So today, you know what? We do the best we can. But we are in relationship. And as a result, if my mom would have dropped dead right at this very moment, I have to tell you, I'd be really sad. I'd be really hurt. But there's no guilt, and there is no unfinished business. There is no unfinished business. I really love my mother today, and I'm grateful she's in my life. And the other thing you find on that list today is the gift of God. You know, I came in here as someone who believed I was an agnostic, and if you're new and aren't clear on the difference between an atheist and an agnostic. An atheist just doesn't believe that God exists at all, that there's any semblance of a power greater than ourselves. An agnostic believes that it exists, but not for them. See, I grew up with the God of my fire, with the God of my childhood being the God of hellfire and brimstone. So I knew there was a God. I just didn't like it. You know, that God wasn't my friend. That God was not on my scene, on my team. So I wanted no part of it. And so as a young kid at 14, I just sort of ostracized God from my life. And when I got sober, you taught me that I could have a God of my understanding. It could look like I wanted it to look. It could feel the way I wanted it to feel. And it could change shapes, you know, over the years. And it did. It went through a process where it morphed into something very different than what it started out being. Really. Today, my God is so sweet. Today, I'm one of those people that would no more do without my faith, as the 11th step tells us, than I would do without air, food, or sunshine. That is how powerful that faith is in my life. And people are always asking me, Francine, how are you able to walk through the fear? They're always saying, how can you do it? How can you walk through the fear? And that's how I do it. It's that faith. It's God. God is in my pocket. God is on my shoulder. God moves in and around and through me. And it's that faith that gives me the courage to do the things that I don't think I can do. And finally, the last thing you'd find on that list today is the gift of love. I came in here with just a hatred of all people, you know, and particularly the people who I believe are different from me. And I must tell you, today I've come to believe that there's only 2% of our makeup that separates us from each other, in my opinion. You see, I believe if the lights were dimmed in here and I couldn't see you, I wouldn't be able to know who you were. The only thing I'd be able to relate to is your spirit, which is what God wants me to relate to. What separates us is race, gender, sexual orientation, religion. That's what separates us, and that's what we make bigger than life. But you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you taught me how to really have an open heart. And I have to tell you, I don't do it perfectly, but I do it better than I've ever done. And you know how you can tell? You look at who's in my life. See, I'm a believer that the proof is in the pudding. You can talk all you want, but who's in my life? I'd be hard-pressed to tell you that I love all people, and you don't see anybody in my life who's different than me. I'd be really hard-pressed to tell you that I love all people, and yet I hate anybody for the color of their skin, or their sexual orientation, or their religious choices. And in my circle, you get to see it all. The women I sponsor come in all different shapes, sizes, and colors. The women I coach for a living and the women I mentor look like the whole spectrum of the universe. And furthermore, the man I'm married to, my husband's Jewish, and he's from the Bronx. I have to tell you, that's a diversity issue. But it's not the diversity issue. In our house, the real diversity issue is my husband is a therapist. Go figure, a lawyer and a therapist. I mean, just figure that one, a lawyer and a therapist. But that's the diversity issue in my family. You know, I get to walk like I talk. People who knew me for years and years never would have thought I would have wound up with a therapist, ever. I'm not... No, they never would have thought I would have wound up with a therapist. And yet today my heart is open. My heart's open. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what you have enabled me to do in 25 years. And you know what? There's more to learn. I'm not stopping. Every day there's a new challenge, a new growth experience. And I'm so grateful that I get to show up for it. I'd like to end by reading something from conference-approved literature. Just for the few AA purists that I know are in the room. I know. This is actually my favorite passage, and I always like to end my talks with this. It's from As Bill Sees It, which is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book if you're newly sober. It's a compilation of pieces from other AA literature, as well as letters from Bill Wilson and to Bill Wilson. This is entitled Can We Choose, and it's on page 4. We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And that's what you've given me in 25 years of sobriety, the gift of choice. You taught me that it doesn't matter where I've come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, doesn't matter whether I believe in God or I don't. You've taught me that the only thing that matters in the overall scheme of things is where I'm going and what I do with this most precious gift you have given to me. Not just in words, but how do my feet move? What do I do with this gift? And you've taught me that it's important what I do with this gift, not just in an AA meeting. How do I treat people out there in traffic? How do I treat people on the line in the supermarket? How do I treat people on the line at the bank? How do I treat my coworkers? How do I treat my husband? Do I treat my husband like a dog and yet I go treat my sponsees like little goddesses? You know, you've taught me that it's about taking the black words off the white pages in this blue book. So that's the deal. It's how I practice these principles in all my affairs. And all you've asked me over the years is that I always be willing to share the gift you've given to me. And for that, I am so grateful. God bless you and namaste.